listening to Real Talk on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
You're on Reality Check Radio. It's Real Talk with Rodney Hyde. Please remember, you can send me a text at 2057, email me inbox at realitycheck.radio. Well, we do like having, I'll be a bit careful, youngish people on who give us their views on the world. We do like learning about the world around us, and we've got to learn today about the property market from a youngish man who's had a very interesting life, Ed McKnight. Good morning.
Great to see you, Rodney.
You work for Opus. Have I got that right, partners?
Yeah, that's correct.
What are they?
So we're a property investment company based in Auckland and Christchurch. And look, we're trying to get a lot of houses built because we know New Zealand's got a housing crisis. And so we help property investors buy new built houses.
Okay. So a builder builds a house on spec. Does Opus buy the house, or does it connect someone who wants to invest in a house?
Yeah, we connect somebody who wants to invest in the house.
Mainly. So it's a second house for them.
Yeah. And then we've got a company that helps rent it out. We own a company that gets the mortgage. We do the accounting.
Oh,
so
wow.
It's kind of a turnkey, or, you know, one-stop shop, some people like to call it, for property investors.
And you're an economist for them, or an analyst for them, checking out the best properties to buy.
Yeah, well, it's quite interesting. If you look at share trading or managed fund companies or any wealth management company who are really invested, for want of a better word, in funds and shares and those kinds of things, they will have an army of analysts trying to find the best stocks, the best investment opportunities. But when you look at the property market, and a lot of Kiwis want to invest in property, there's never been the same intellectual rigor. So you see people doing things.
So obvious as soon as you say it.
It is. It's so obvious. So people do things like just buy the house next door. Well, is that a good investment? Nobody really knows. But my house went up in value, so maybe the next door neighbor, maybe that'll go up in value as well. And maybe one day, some random day in the future, no specific date, maybe I'll sell it to a developer. But that's the kind of thing or process that a lot of Kiwis do. And so what I'm trying to do is just put a little more rigor around it. And so I do things like go and spend, I just recently went and spent 10 grand with CoreLogic, which is a property data company, to buy data to see, do new builds, the sort of properties we recommend, do they go up in value at the same rate as secondhand houses, the one you just drive down the street that most people are usually buying? Because if a new build goes up in value at the same rate as an existing property, that would be very interesting to know for our investors. Well, the answer is yes, it does. But nobody had thought to answer that question, right? And if we're trying to encourage lots of houses to be built because we all agree, oh, we don't have enough houses in New Zealand, we need more rental stock, then an investor needs to know that it's actually a good investment, but nobody had answered the question before. Wow. And so these are some of the interesting things. Some other things that I've done is looking at suburbs in different cities. And so I've created maps of almost every large city in New Zealand, looking at, well, which suburbs have gone up in value faster than others. Perhaps that suggests that there's more of an investment opportunity there. Which suburbs tend to have higher rental yields? And just giving this information out and putting it out there. A lot of the data has always been around, but it's just about packaging it in a way that regular mums and dads who are scrolling on the internet can just get that little bit of intellectual rigor around how they're making that investment decision because it's never been there.
And, of course, that is presumably that analysis is done for commercial property.
I'd imagine that bigger companies who focus on commercial property probably do that, you know, really dive into the numbers for their commercial investors. But the trouble with commercial property is there are much higher barriers to entry.
Yes.
For the average Kiwi, you know, you've got to have some money or equity, a lot of equity in your home if you're going to go and do that. And so we're just trying to do it for residential property because that's what a lot of Kiwis talk about at barbecues, and just trying to answer some of those questions that everybody kind of has. What's a good rental yield? How much do house prices go up by per year? Is it different in small towns versus big cities? All of these kinds of questions. Townhouses versus apartments versus houses. What goes up in value faster? What rental yield should it be for a townhouse versus an apartment? All of the data's out there. You just have to get it and put it in a way that people can understand.
Because otherwise it's like old wives' tales, or this is what Fred did. And we tend to invest in residential property because everyone's bought a house, or, you know, may have bought a house. And so it's like, oh, well, I've done that once. I've got a bit of money. I could do that again. And it's not like a whole new thing of going into commercial property or into a business or into the share market. It's something that you know. And when you look back over recent history, it's been a damn good investment.
Mm. The other thing that we often see a lot of Kiwis do is they buy a house for what I call an emotional reason, which might not be an investment decision, but we do it for things like, okay, I'm going to buy a house in Tauranga because I might like to retire there in 20 years. Property prices tend to go up, so I'll go and buy a property in Tauranga now so that I'm not priced out later on. Or I'd really like to own a house in Queenstown because I like going to Queenstown. Or maybe I should buy that house down the road because my kid is going to need a rental property and then I can rent it out to them. So there's often these kind of personal factors that come in as well. And I often try and encourage Kiwis not to do that. Yes. Because you might end up making $1 million mistake because you're not buying the best investment property. And so again, it's just that kind of separation between our what we call home buyer mindset, where you're just buying a house for yourself or you're buying a house for personal reasons, and that investor mindset where you're actually thinking about the numbers and doing the analysis and the research.
You said new houses. Is that your exclusive focus, buying new builds?
We solely focus on new builds. And the main reason. The main reason is all of the regulation around it. And so if you think about, I'll give you some real simple numbers. Let's say you go and you buy $1 million house today. The deposit you need sitting here, the rules are about to change again, but the deposit for a new build is 200K. The deposit for an existing house is 300K. So you need 50% more money. But then
is that a government rule or a bank rule?
That's a Reserve Bank rule. Okay. So under the LVR restrictions. And then you say, okay, well, if those houses double in value over the next 15 to 20 years, then they've both made $1 million. But the new build, you made $1 million and you put 200K in. With the existing property, you made $1 million and you put 300K in. So the return on your investment is higher typically through a new build because you get the same amount of capital growth, the same amount of house price increase, but you put less money in. And then we've also got the new rules from the Reserve Bank, which are about to come in July, the debt-to-income ratio rules, which limit how much you can borrow and ties it to your income. And the Reserve Bank modelling suggests that you can grow your portfolio up to 2 times as quickly if you then invest in new builds rather than existing properties. And so it's mainly because of the government rules that really favour new builds.
Mm. And they've done that deliberately, right, through the Reserve Bank.
Yeah, the Reserve Bank wants more houses to be built, right? And the reason is they don't, from a financial stability perspective, they don't want house prices to boom and bust. Because that really causes financial stress. It might mean that people default on their mortgages and then that would harm the banks. And so the Reserve Bank saying, hey, we want to help increase the supply of properties. And so as we bring in regulation, so the loan-to-value ratio restrictions, which is the deposit side, and now the DTIs, debt-to-income ratios, that's regulating the income side of the mortgage application. They're saying we want to encourage new build investment.
When you're buying when you are advising an investor to buy a new house, how do you ensure it's not a lemon?
That's a really good question, right? Well, we go out and we source properties from developers. So the first thing is to make sure that it actually stacks up as a good return. in terms of the properties. And so what I did as the economist, I went and I built a big spreadsheet that runs the numbers. And so I gave it to our property team and said, cool, this is where you put the numbers in. It spits out a single number, what we call the return on investment. And then we've kind of got targets based on our view of the market and how it will evolve around how good an investment should it be? You know, what should that specific return on investment number be? So that's how we try and evidence to the investor, hey, we've actually done some research around this. But then there's we've got a whole compliance team now because of the Financial Markets Authority and what we need to do with that government organisation. And we've got whole checklists about how do we check out the developer and make sure that they are financially robust so they don't start a property, start building something, and then fall over.
Because that's tough, right?
Yeah, and it's quite worrying at the moment when property prices have been down. There are some developers who at the height of the market signed up to purchase land. Then they might say, cool, we're going to purchase this piece of land and in a year or 2 years, we're going to pay for it and start developing it. But what's happened over the last 1 to 2 years is that property prices have fallen, but developers have locked in the price when prices were very, very high and then they come unstuck now. We're pretty proud that most of the ones that we thought were going to be financially unsustainable, we stayed away from them, and we're kind of seeing that that was a pretty good decision now, because we're pretty worried about especially some bigger developers that probably overexpanded.
What about lemons in the sense of leaky or poor workmanship that isn't visible to the eye?
Yeah, that's a good point. So one of the things that we're real big on, and people think we're a bit crazy for it, is once the property's built, get a building inspector through. And you might think, but it's a brand new house. Why do I need to get a building inspector? Well, it's pretty much exactly for the reason that you've identified, Rodney. And the big ones that get picked up are things you wouldn't even think. So one of the most common issues you see with a new build property is the showers not being connected. And so tenants might move into this brand new house, they're showering away, but the bottom of the shower isn't connected correctly to the pipe beneath. And so all of the shower water just sticks underneath the shower. And then you've got the potential for rot and just a whole heap of bad things. And so building inspector goes in, makes sure that it's connected correctly. We actually had another situation where sometimes toilets have not been connected correctly. So there was one situation, we sent a building inspector in before the client had paid for the property and checked out the different toilets, and so went in and flushed them all. Two out of three of them were connected correctly. The third one wasn't. Now, the builder kicked back and said, no, of course it's connected correctly. Building inspector takes them through, shows them it's not connected correctly. It wasn't. Now you think, okay, well, what's the issue with this? Well, if the tenants moved in, started doing their business in the toilet, flushing away, and then the waste is not being taken away from the house correctly, you're going to have a real stink in three weeks or so. And so even though it's a new build, I still recommend people get a building inspector to double check that the $600,000-$800,000 that you've spent on this house has actually gotten you the house that works the way you expect it to.
And of course, if it's your own house and you're living in it and you've got a problem with the toilet, you sort of deal with it because you have to. But if it's a tenant, it's like, oh, it's a biohazard. I can't stay here. Oh, you know, like you've got a whole different, because they're paying for a house that works.
Yeah.
And having poo under your floorboards coming up is not a working house.
Yeah. And those kind of issues are one-offs. They're not for every house, right? But you want to catch them. You really want to catch them.
I would have thought these days, with the council all over the building thing, the building inspectors, that they would catch this, but stuff is slipping through.
Well, some stuff will always slip through because a council building inspector, to the best of my knowledge, you know, like they are not what I would call a typical building inspector, where they're going through and checking absolutely everything. They'll have their checklists that they've got to tick off, and I'm sure they do a very good job at that for most councils. But there are some things that can always be missed, especially when you're building a house, right? Because it's a complex thing. In fact, you were just telling me off air that you're building a couple of cabins as well. You'll know as well, you know, some things can get missed. So it's about adding those layers of protection in so that our investors have a very good experience, because we're trying to help people be quite hands-off property investors so that they can still continue with their lives, you know, do their jobs, look after their kids, and have property as an investment ticking it over in the background. So we want to make sure that's a good experience.
I'll tell you a funny story about building cabins. I've learned that you can be driving down the road and you think, oh, they've done that. They've done that Safete, like I want to do my Safete. And then you go on to the council consent process and it details the plans and actually details the building inspections. And I ended up learning a lot about building by going over these plans and building inspections for comparable houses, funnily enough. But I was truly shocked at how many times building inspectors would pull terrible mistakes up, take the picture, and put it in the online for the public to see. And these would be reputable nationwide brands. Right, and not a cheap house.
Okay, I'm going to have to go. That's given me some good content to go away and look at.
Oh, wow. You talk to my wife. She's expert at it. And you'd almost think that when you read this building inspection, knock this back, knock that back, that you wouldn't want to buy the house. You know what I mean? But, of course, a big part of it is, as I understand it now, a lot of the houses are being built by subcontractors. You know, you get a group in to put the frame up, you get a group in to do the lining, you get a group up to do the roof, you get a group in to do, you know, literally the suite. And when they're building down here in Queenstown, they're building whole new subdivisions, and you'll see 10 houses in a row, and the crews are working down the road doing their one thing. And it's easy, you can imagine it's easy to, someone puts the toilet in, someone puts the plumbing in, and there's not a person to connect. You know what I mean? Oh, boy, good for you. So tell me this. I'm thinking about buying a second house. I got left some money by a dear aunt, say. I'm making the story up. I had lots of dear aunts, but they never left me money. And I think, oh, I might buy a house. Now, I could buy the one next door because I can keep an eye on it, or I could go to OPS Partners, right? What would you do for me then, and how much would you cost me?
So the first thing, I'll just answer the cost question because that's such a common one. We actually don't charge for finding the property. And the reason is because if we go out and we find a whole heap of properties from developers, we charge them instead. Because when we set up the company, we could make the decision. We could either charge the investor or we could charge the developer. And we thought, well, we can probably help a lot more people if we just charge the developer, because us Kiwis don't generally like to pay for advice.
No.
And so we go out, we find these properties and actually don't charge. It's a bit like a mortgage broker where, you know, you go to a mortgage broker, you don't actually pay them anything most of the time. And then they go get the money, the mortgage from the bank, and they charge the bank the commission instead. But the main reason that a lot of people might decide to come through us is that we'd encourage you not to invest in the house right next to you. And the reason is, at the moment, you're living in central Otago. And so if you've got two properties in central Otago, you're quite reliant on that specific part of the market. And what we tend to see is that property prices around New Zealand don't all go up at the same time. So between 2008 and 2016, Wellington property prices were very, very flat. But property prices in Auckland went off like a frog in a sock between 2012 and 2016. So Auckland's rocketing up while Wellington pretty darn flat. Similarly, during the COVID boom, house prices went up in Wellington and Auckland, but they went up much faster in Christchurch, despite the fact that Christchurch had just had a very flat market for a while. And so you kind of see each region, each part of the country in its own little property cycle. And so what I encourage investors to do is to kind of buy houses around the country. And the reason is, then if you've got one going up in value while the other's flat, you don't feel so bad about yourself, and you more closely approximate the national house price or average house price.
And then the great thing is, I don't have to sit at home and try and do a spreadsheet and think of all my costs and risks. You do that for me with the experience.
Yeah, it's a lot of the technical stuff. So one thing we've probably been quite bad at is people will say, cool, yeah, I'll come to you and I'll get my financial plan done, because we are financial advisors, so we create the whole financial plan. We've got our own piece of software we built for that. Yeah, okay, I could do that. I could come get a plan. I can come see you and get a property. But, you know, I could do that myself. And so we've been, I think, quite bad at marketing, because then people see that and think, well, I could do that myself. The real service is the 12 months while the property's being built, getting all your building inspections, organizing the chattel valuer to save you on tax, organizing the getting an accountant to talk to you about, well, are you going to use a company? Are you going to use a trust? Getting the building inspector in there, getting the property manager in there to make sure that there's a tenant, and kind of doing the doing of property investment for you to make it a bit easier. I think that's a big part of it.
I'll tell you a funny story. And I don't know if listeners will appreciate this. I talk too much sometimes, but I have a son who lives in New York, but growing up boy. He paid someone to buy a car for him.
Okay, tell me about that.
And I thought this was the nuttiest thing I'd ever heard, right? Like, this is a New York thing. He said everyone does it. You don't even think about buying your own car. So you pay a guy, and he's exactly like Opus Partners. He knows exactly what the Ford Motor Company is making that retailer pay for that car. And he turns up and says, well, you're going to sell a car today, gentlemen, but you're only going to make $200 on it. Here's the price I'm giving you. He actually has inside knowledge of the cars, right? And he said he saves you thousands of dollars on the purchase of the car. Then, because of the crazy tax rules in the US, he structures the ownership of the car as a lease and all the whatnot and how to do it and all the rest of it to minimize your tax obligations and your payments. Job done. He said it's thousands of dollars.
Really interesting. You see a similar thing in Australia. Over there, you've got what's called buyer's advocates. Now, this is back in housing rather than cars. But because house prices are quite high over there and you've got different states with different rules and different stamp duties, they've got this whole industry around what they call buyer's agents or buyer's advocates, where you pay this person to go and find you the right investment property. Or I've even heard stories about, you might have a husband and wife team and they are the buyer's advocates that I've now hired. I send them into the auction room and the wife's bidding for me, and so is the husband. But then the husband starts, you know, making noise about, oh, this is a ridiculous price, and storms out of the room to try and work the emotions of the people in the auction room. And then the wife's quietly there just bidding very, very slowly, trying to keep the price quite low. And so it's quite interesting that, yes, you could buy a house, you could buy a car on your own, but sometimes, especially in quite complex industries, you get what we call in economics asymmetric information.
Yes.
Where the builder knows something more about building a house than you do, or, you know, the developer knows more about the price that they can sell it for or what they've built it for. In your example of the cars, the retailer knows what they've paid for it and you don't necessarily know. And so sometimes you might want to hire someone who's got more of that industry-based knowledge to help you make the best decision.
We're the worst people, aren't we? Because I love car salesmen, because they're so good at it, right? And you walk up and they say, oh, man, you can spot a good car, you know? And you say, yeah, no, I'm pretty good at it, mate. And he says, look, seeing it's you, I'm going to knock a thousand. Oh, my goodness, a thousand. And your wife says, yeah, I like red. And you buy the car.
You're so right about that. I like red. And except it's not, it's, you know, that'd be me in my relationship. Oh, yeah, I really like that one because I wanted a white car with tan seats. And so, you know, and so I wanted that one.
Yeah, it is amazing. And so, as you say, these markets are sophisticated. You definitely have asymmetric information. So you do. I can see why that expertise. Also, you need logic poured over your emotion. There's an emotional purchase. Buying a house, buying a car, these are emotional purchases. I just like that. Oh, I like that. Like you say, that idea. And you need someone to say, hang on, just come back and have a look at the spreadsheet. This is going to eat you.
I'll give you a really interesting example as well of where we kind of took some data. So one way to get away from an emotional decision is just to look at the numbers. And one of the big things is, well, what do tenants want? And I think we all have an opinion because we live in a house. So I've lived in a house before. I know what people want in a house and what people will pay for. But what's really interesting is that Statistics New Zealand have all the numbers about what tenants currently rent in every suburb in the country. And the trouble is that it's hidden on some terrible website deep in the depths of Stats NZ's, you know, website and different platforms. And so I just dug it all out, downloaded it all, ran it through some spreadsheets, ran it through some AI to match up Remuera North and Remuera South and Remuera Southeast to just put it all in Remuera, and then put it all online so that you can then say, okay, well, we think that tenants in Remuera or tenants in Papatoetoe want a four-bedroom house with a double garage. Let's put it in and see what tenants are actually renting there. And one thing that really surprised me is how many houses just have one person living in them. Do you know something like 30% of New Zealand renters are just single people?
No.
One person living in a house. It actually blew my mind when I looked at it.
Wow.
Now, of course, it depends on the specific suburb, but it's amazing. Sometimes
are they subletting it or not necessarily?
No, this is a single person. So this is based on census data. You know, and they say, well, how many people are living in your house? Say one person. Oh, okay, that gets put in there. And it might be
sometimes. And they're not owning it, they're renting it.
Yeah, in these cases, they're renting it.
The breakup of relationships, which has become a constant thing, has also must have had a big impact on the rental market because you have an ex-husband and an ex-wife and they live on their own for 1 week and then the next week they have all the kids turn up.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I just did a video on YouTube talking about the future of house prices and I was saying that generally when people think about housing demand, we just think about population. And is the population going up or is the population going down? But the other thing we've got to think about is household formation. So how many new households are there? And I was giving it the example of my parents who split up when I was 8. And I said, well, that's a great example of where you had 6 people. So mum, dad, me, and there were 4 of us kids. You got 6 people living in one house. Then you get divorced and mum and dad now have 2 households. So it was one family living in one house. Now we've got 2, let's call it separate families now, living in 2 different houses. But can dad just buy or rent a 1-bedroom property? No. They both need 4-bedroom properties because the kids go between the 2. And so that's really interesting where housing demand went up even though you've got the same number of people because you've got what we call new housing formation.
Yes. You've got to be rich to get divorced. Was it traumatic for you, your parents splitting?
Yeah, it was, Rodney. I remember, it's funny what you remember, because I was speaking actually to one of my employees the other day, and yesterday, and I said, okay, you're getting divorced. What's that like for your kids? Your kids are 5 and maybe 7. And he says, no, I think they're pretty sweet. I didn't have the heart to tell him that the kids probably wouldn't be sweet, because I remember the day after my parents got divorced, I was sitting in Miss Scown's classroom at Tuturutu Primary School in Hawera, 8 years old, just crying at my desk. And I just, you know, it's really in my mind, you know, I really remember it. And, you know, you don't really know what's going on, but you know that something's going on, because we got woken up probably at 11 p.m. or whatever, 10 p.m. We were all asleep. And Mum says, right, come on, we're going off. We're all going to go stay at her sister's house, my auntie's house. I mean, what's quite funny, they always tell me the story, is that I was very emotional, little emotional eight-year-old at that point. And then they said, come on, Ed, we'll go to KFC. And I said, yippee. we didn't have a lot of takeaways when I was a kid, so that was exciting. I do remember that. I now look back at it and think, well, if that's what my mum had to do, that's what she had to do for herself, and you know, good on her for making the decision. But it was a bit traumatic at that specific time. Doesn't mean it was the wrong decision, but it was.
Did you grow up oscillating between the two households?
At the start, yes. And then the relationship between me and my dad kind of broke down.
Okay. I can't imagine it. I truly can't. And I mean that most genuinely, because when I was growing up, probably like you were up until you're eight, your mum and dad are there for you and they're a unit. And your dad's the greatest man in the world, and your mum's the most loving woman in the world. And I met a fellow whose dad was a gang member, and he passed away. And he told me how rough it was. And he told me, you know, he was a complete bad man, but he was my dad and I loved him. So I can't imagine not growing up with that rock and these two special people who were one in my mind looking after me, each with their role, you know. You wouldn't go crying to Dad, but you'd go crying to Mum, you know. You'd go running to Dad because you'd pulled something off that was brave and courageous, or you needed help fixing your bicycle, you know. It's like you did your manly things with Dad and your feminine things with Mum, sort of thing. So it's very, very tough.
Yeah.
Your relationship with your dad now?
Not really. Not hugely. And I kind of feel okay about that, actually.
Yeah. You've got to work this through. Like, there's no way. You can't go through life reliving a trauma.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You've got to deal with it and get on, because you owe it to yourself and to your family and to your friends and to your work and to your customers. You owe it to them to get over yourself. So I didn't mean to sort of say, oh, this is going to, oh, terrible. I read online about these people and they say, oh, this terrible thing happened to me. And you think, what?
Oh, like when you're a kid? Yeah, you got to move on with your life.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
One thing that I will say, because they were just talking about it, Rodney, here we go. Here's the real truth, because this is Reality Check Radio. I do often think what life would have been like if some of my family members weren't so mean about him. So after my parents got divorced,
yes,
and I think it's quite natural, people start telling the kids about the bad things about their father.
Yes.
And you know, he probably said a few things, not as many, that might have been bad about my mother. I, as somebody who went through it, like, I think that is the worst thing you could possibly do for the child. And I do think, you know, would I have a better relationship with my dad if those things, bad things, hadn't been said about him? Whether they were true or not.
Yes, best not know.
Best not to know. Because, you know, maybe life would have been different. Now, look, I'm totally fine now. I don't, you know, sit around thinking, like, really thinking, you know, what might have been. But I do think now, like, if I ever had kids, and I know it's so much easier to say than do, so I don't want to come across as very preachy about how to go through a divorce, because that's traumatic for everybody. But I think you always want to be careful, because children listen, and children that, remember.
Yeah. How did you get into opera singing?
Well, that's an interesting one. So we went to church a lot when I was a kid, and it was one of those kinds of hands in the air, like you just don't care churches.
Yeah.
And a lot of singing. And being in that church kind of choirish thing, always wanted to be the loudest. It's, to be honest, I'm probably just a terrible attention seeker.
Yes.
That's probably what you're thinking, and you're probably half right. And I just loved it. I really liked singing. And so my mum got me lessons when I was 10. And when you go and get singing lessons, generally it kind of, at least in the circles I grew up in, it tended to be more classical. And to be honest, I just didn't stop. So I started at 10 and I just kept on going. Then I got a scholarship to go to a high school in Auckland, went to Dilworth. That's where I met you when I became your youth MP in 2010.
Yes,
and then I decided, well, I'll just continue on at university. So I did economics and opera singing. And then I kind of got to 22 and decided to stop. but between the years of age of 10 and 22, I just kept on doing it. And it's quite amazing. The people that I see be successful, especially in opera singing, are the ones who just never stopped. So I've got
Isn't
a friend.
Isn't that amazing about life?
But it's so true.
It is absolutely true. The key to everything is to keep doing it.
So if I think about a guy called Felipe Manu, he's a guy I went to high school with. And we were both singing, you know, we did a lot together, flatmates for a time, went to university together. He never stopped. He was also much more talented than me, but he also never stopped. And in August this year, I'm going to fly across to Sydney to go watch him perform one of the leads at the Sydney Opera House. And he's performed at the Paris National Opera. I think he's singing at Scottish Opera. He's done stuff in Switzerland. He is a serious international opera singer coming out of South Auckland, Tongan guy, wonderful guy, and hugely talented. But he never stopped, and now he is a serious international opera singer.
Isn't it amazing? Yeah, also, I'm also a little troubled by people, for them, who are very good at something. And because they're very good at it, they're channeled into it by their mentors and their coaches and their family and their teachers. Oh, you're going to be a great opera star and all the rest of it. And I think, whoa, it could be a curse being really good at one thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because you're unlikely to be the best in the world. You know, you're unlikely to just make that thing, right? So there's that frustration. But also, I've known people who were very good at something and concentrated on it, and they missed out on such a lot. You know, like, it's hard comparison, but your friend, the opera singer, hasn't done what you've done. You know what I mean? Because you have to dedicate yourself to that thing, which is a wonderful obsession. And we all clap and cheer when they do well, particularly in sport. And then when they don't do well, we say, oh, what happened? You say, hey, the guy was better than me. But so tough a world that you can make for yourself to be that one thing.
Yeah, what I'd say that I think can be tough is that your path can kind of be defined for you by other people.
From a young age.
Yeah, and you know, sometimes I feel a bit embarrassed about my career because I bounced around in those first, you know, 5 to 6 years doing random things. And then you read my CV and people think, how the hell did he end up being an economist at a property investment firm? And, you know, eventually I became a shareholder in it as well. And it's really strange because I started out wanting to be an opera singer. Then I thought, well, I'm probably not, if I'm really honest with myself, I'm probably not going to be a serious international opera singer. I'm probably not going to be able to achieve my ambitions with it. So maybe I'll try something else. And then I thought, well, do you know what I should be? My goal should be by 32, I want to be the CEO of Opera Australia. And I'm going to get into the management of arts organisations. So I go off and I work for the Auckland Philharmonia Orchestra, which is a great orchestra in Auckland. And then you realise, oh my gosh, running an arts organisation is incredibly hard because it's so expensive to put things on and you can't sell enough tickets because people aren't as into it as they once were. You know, not enough people buy tickets to make the thing break even. And so you've got to get government funding. So I'm like, oh gosh, this is very hard. And, you know, I'm not a big believer in government funding for anything anyway. So I'm not sure if this is really my thing. So then I go off and I try and think, okay, well, I'll go work for a bank. And then the bank didn't give me a job. That's fine. So then I went and worked for a friend's web design and digital agency. So I try and get some shares in that, and oh no, that didn't work. And so then I think, okay, well, I'll come back to my roots and become a property economist, and hey, this is the thing that worked for me. And so sometimes I look at that and I think, well, gosh, it's quite embarrassing because I bounced around for 5 to 6 years. But then I think, well, that's what led me to doing something that I really like today.
Absolutely.
And have dedicated the last 5 years of my life to, and will probably dedicate the next 15 years at
and
least of my life to it.
And you don't want to settle for the first thing you hit upon.
Yeah,
it may not be your thing. I'm a little older than you. You're 31.
Yeah,
I'm
that's
a little
right.
older than 31.
How old are you, Rodney?
Do you know, I don't know if I'm 67 or 68 or 69. I was born in 1956, whatever that is. I've lost count. 70 will hit me with a force, like 60 did and 50 did and 40 did. But I just don't know. But I'm in my late 60s. And I'm still trying to work out what to do when I grow up.
I love it.
I seriously think that. In my head, I'm a little kid. I did a terrible thing when my kids were little. I should say this. We're talking to Ed McKnight, who's a property analyst at Opus. And we got sidetracked into opera singing. I did a terrible thing to my kids when they were little. They said, oh, how old are you, Dad? And I was 61, and I said I was 16, and they believed me. And then it became a thing that I couldn't unwind it. And they started to ask, you know, like a year later, they'd say, well, how come, you know, you can drive a car? And all sorts of stuff. And then when they found out, they were devastated. It was just a silly joke. Anyway, I feel that. I feel like a young person.
But I think in there, there's something really interesting about sometimes we get stuck in how we define ourselves.
Yeah.
You know, and you say, oh, well, you know, at one point you were a politician. And you said that, well, I'm a politician. This is what I'm always going to be. And then, no, you're not. You're something else. And actually, maybe we'll dig into this. I remember when I was being interviewed to be a youth MP, and I was talking to one of your staff members, and she was saying, oh, yes, well, you know, Rodney worked on an oil rig. Oh, yes, well, you know, Rodney's got a degree in, is it zoology?
Yeah.
And Rodney did this. I thought, how the hell did this guy become a politician? He bounced around from this to then and different.
Oh, still
things.
Bouncing. I did a degree in zoology. I did a degree in botany. I got a master's degree in environmental science. I got a master's degree in economics. I worked on oil rigs. I worked in construction. I worked on. Do you know what I did when I left Parliament?
No idea.
I worked helping a digger driver.
Oh, yeah. How good.
And we would clean up where there'd been a slip. And I loved it. And you know why the digger driver loved me working with them in overalls, digging out slips with buckets and shovels?
No, why's that?
Because we're doing it for the Earthquake Commission. And the homeowner would say, that looks like Rodney Hyde, because I was fresh out of politics. And he says, oh, yeah, it is. Oh, would you like a cup of tea? And we'd always get morning tea because I was there.
Oh, how good.
Morning tea when you're not with me. No, I think bouncing around, and it's a tragedy because, you know, it's a funny thing. I just feel very, I think, what am I going to do next? I find it exciting. And I sort of admire people that found their thing early and stuck to it, but it's not been my experience. Cover off something. I'm talking to Ed McKnight, property man with Opus. Tell me, when I've bought my property through you, you then can manage it for us, right? You said that. So like you'd find the tenant, look after the property, and it would be completely passive to me in terms of what I'm doing. Is that true?
Yeah, that's the goal that we have, right? So just outside where I'm recording this now, we've got our property management team. They're out there looking for tenants, doing the inspections. You know, there's a whole heap of things that people don't realise that they've got to do when they become property investors.
Mm.
And, I mean, maybe that's a good thing that they don't realise it up front, otherwise they might not do it. But did you know that if you don't do your inspections every 3 months, then your insurance can become void, and then if your house burns down, the insurance company might not pay you out for it. So you've got to be doing your inspections regularly, but a lot of people let that lapse. And so, yep, we're doing that with the property managers. You're going to want to look at how your mortgage is set up. Can we set it up to pay it off faster? Well, I've got a mortgage team out there who sit there every day helping people do that. I've got an insurance team that sits there and says, well, okay, Rodney, you've currently bought this property, but what happens if you lose your job and you lose your income? How long until you're living in your car? Well, for most people, it's about 8 weeks or so. And I say, okay, well, you don't want to sell this property quickly. You don't want to be in a position where you've got to sell it quickly because that's going to ruin your retirement. So let's make sure you get income protection and insurance. And then we've got accountants because then you've got to think about the tax situation. So there's all of these things that you've got to do that you probably don't realize you've got to do. And no. We're just kind of wanting to say, well, if you want us to handle it for you, we can do that.
And then do you just take a slice of the weekly earnings of the property?
Yeah, so that's how property management works. Usually people charge somewhere around that 8% plus GST mark.
Okay. I don't mean to be rude, but I can see you and listeners can't. It looks like you work out in a serious way.
Oh, that's very kind of you, Rodney. I'll tell you a couple of stories because I don't know how much into my life you want to get, but I'll basically tell you anything. What's really interesting is that when I was 18, I go off to university and I put on a lot of weight, probably about 10 kilos in a year. And I remember that my aunt, Marianne, when I came home for Christmas that year, who I should say was a bigger woman herself, said to me, Ed, do you really need that extra lolly or something like that? And I was so offended, Rodney. Oh, so offended. But she was right. And that was the truth of it. So even though I was offended, I knew she was right, which annoyed me even more.
Yeah.
Which annoyed me. And so I thought, rightio. So the next year, I ran a lot. And I thought, I'm going to get into running. I'm going to be better with my eating. I lost 20 kilos that year. And then I became very skinny over a long period of time, even though I was going to the gym a lot. And then it wasn't until probably 2 and a bit years ago now. We do a lot of videos. I've got a YouTube channel for Opus Partners. I've got a daily podcast I do. We've done over 1,700 episodes of that now for the Property Academy podcast.
Oh, yes. What is your daily podcast that people can...
Yeah, Property Academy podcast. We've done that every single day for almost the last 5 years
now. Is it
now.
Free or do you need to pay to receive it?
No, it's free. You just get it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, all of those
Property
things.
Property Academy podcast, Ed McKnight. Yes, yep. I should have mentioned that. You're amazing.
Pretty much anyway, anything, any question you ever want to know. So anyway, so I'm looking at these videos and my business partner, Andrew, he had been going to the gym and working out and getting bigger. And I looked at that video and I said to my videographer, David, what camera tricks are you playing? Because Andrew looks very big. And he looked at me and he says, Ed, it's because Andrew lifts really effing heavy weights. And it was a bit like that moment with my Aunt Marianne, where she said to me that I was too fat. And I thought, he's right. Because sometimes you've got a choice when people give you you in the face with the truth.
Or take it on board.
I could either say that David doesn't know what he's talking about, that Marianne doesn't know what she's talking about. Or you could say, actually, they're right. And so I started going to a personal trainer. And the amazing thing, Rodney, is I'd been going to the gym consistently. I was very consistent for probably about 7 or 8 years, but I had never put on any serious muscle. And the reason is because I did not have a trainer. I did not have somebody telling me regular truth bombs like that, like, Ed, well, you just need to have 2 protein shakes a day. Ed, you're not lifting heavy enough. Ed, you're not progressing enough. Actually, the other big thing, Ed, you're running before you're lifting weights. That's going to make you far weaker. That's the reason why you're not making any progress. I wasted probably about 8 years going to the gym and made no real progress because, a bit like that asymmetric information, I didn't know what the hell I was doing.
Mm.
So over the last 2 years, I've put on about 20 kilos again. This time, not all fat. Some of it's fat. But it's amazing that there are a couple of lessons, I think, from that story. First of all, when somebody hits you in the face with the truth, you've got the decision. Do you reject it or do you do something about it? Generally, I think it's better if you do something about it, because often there will be a kernel of truth in it, even if you didn't like how the person said it. So look for the kernel of truth. And then the big thing was about getting the personal trainer, the coach, that really changed things for me, because then I'm doing things that I didn't, movements that I didn't know how to do before, or I might have been too scared to test at the gym on my own.
Deadlift, squat.
Bench press, how to do them correctly, yes. How much protein to have, and just consistently doing them. Because
sometimes squats?
Yeah, I do squats.
Deadlifts?
Yeah, I do that.
Shoulder press?
Yeah.
The other four.
Yeah, those are the main ones, right? And you know, little other ones around them. But yeah, I think that really changed my life, because you were telling me about your kids before we hit record, and about how they are more confident because they're into martial arts, right?
Yeah.
And they have a confidence in themselves. Well, going from a very skinny guy to putting on quite a bit of weight and just feeling a little bit muscular, you know, a little bit.
Oh, I know that.
You know, then you start to feel different in yourself. And I think that's actually been the big benefit.
Mm. I did powerlifting.
Oh, yeah. Tell me about that.
Well, I lost weight like you. And then realized I was weak. And over time, I learned to lift weights. And I ended up in the powerlifting gym in Wellington. And I absolutely loved it. It was actually my release when I was MP and minister. And then I went in a few competitions, and just to have the experience of what it was to compete. And it's the only sport that I've ever discovered that I had some natural ability at.
I imagine you'd have a really good squat on you, because you're a pretty stocky guy.
Yeah. And it turns out a lot of it is how your muscles and tendons attach to the bones and the leverage you get. So you'll find, when you study powerlifting, you find that people might be very good, say, at the bench press, but they won't be so good at the squat, or vice versa, because it's just the way their body's made. But then I discovered that to be really good, you have to do it for years and years and years, because what you and I are doing is strengthening our muscles, but the guys and girls that are really good at it have strengthened their bones and their tendons. And that takes a long time. But there's no doubt that lifting weights is the greatest exercise to keep you vital. And I used to feel that same. I'd be sitting in a room and I'd just feel great with people, you know, because you felt like strong. You knew what you could lift and you knew they couldn't. And I remember when I left Parliament, you know, and I'd work, people were sort of shocked what I could lift. But it is a wonderful, good for you. Have you heard of Mark Rippetoe?
I have not. Tell me about him.
You got to get Mark Rippetoe's book, Rippetoe, or online Google Mad Cow 5x5. And you literally can take your personal best lift, you can put in the spreadsheet, and you'll be delivered in a spreadsheet the very best weightlifting program that you could ever have. And once you know how to squat, deadlift, shoulder press, squat, deadlift, bench press, you can actually just program each week in your easy days and your hard days, and it's all there. And there's this great thing about the rules about the program, and one of them is, it's a bit less polite than this, but it says the fifth rule is do not mess with this program. And he developed the best weightlifting programs and was the first guy to start bringing weights into American football. Oh my goodness, it's amazing. So you'll be able to move away from a personal trainer and take responsibility for yourself once you can do the lifts, but you've got to be able to lift correctly. And you put in your personal best and it spits it out, and you'll just watch yourself transform in 3 or 4 months.
Very cool.
It's astonishing. Anyway, tell me this, and then we have to conclude. We've sort of covered a few things, Ed. We should tell people we're talking to Ed McKnight. You're on Real Talk with Rodney Hyde, Reality Check Radio. I didn't mean to do this. We got to talk about property. Then we covered your effect of your parents' divorce on you. We covered off your weightlifting and training and your weight loss. We've covered off your opera singing.
Yeah.
But one last question for you.
Yeah.
What was it like being my youth MP?
So do you know what? It was really interesting because I didn't expect to get it. And the reason
is,
well, because you're in Epsom, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you've got to remember that some of the best schools in the country are in Epsom. So you've got Diocesan School for Girls, Decile 10. Oh, we don't have deciles anyway anymore. But, you know, very elite private girls' school. You've got St. Cuthbert's up the road. You've probably got maybe Auckland Grammar might be in there, or at least a lot of kids who go to Auckland Grammar and King's College as well. You know, really elite, expensive schools. And I went to Dilworth, where everybody's on a scholarship, and it was in the old system, Decile 4, and we're all from straitened circumstances, was the phrase that was used. And so I kind of thought that somebody else would get it. But it was really easy, I suppose. I just applied and wrote down what I thought. And then I got called in for an interview. I can't remember your staff member's name.
Priscilla Tate.
That's right. It was Priscilla. And she sat me down.
Formidable woman. Yeah.
Sat me down for that interview. And we just had a little chit chat. And she said, right, Rodney's running late, but you're it. And I said, I thought I was being interviewed. She was like, yeah, that was just to check you were good enough. And then we went out for coffee. But what was amazing was standing in Parliament and being able to, you know, say some things. And the most interesting part that I remember a lot was I was a very opinionated teenager, very opinionated. And I remember
I remember that about you. No, I do. That's what we liked.
A good way or a bad way?
In a great way.
Okay, I'll take that. And I remember, I hope I don't turn too many people off with this story, but we were talking about smoking. That was the select committee I was on. And they were talking about...
We should say for listeners, they run a program. I don't know, is it every 3 years or every 2 years, where MPs nominate someone and they go down. They might be 16, 17, 18, I guess. And they go down to Parliament. What's it, 3 days, Ed?
Yeah, 2 or 3 days. Yeah.
2 or 3 days, and they stay there, get put up, and they go through all the things that an MP would do. They have the speaker there. The speaker runs it and looks after them, and it's a fantastic experience. And so Ed, 1 year, was my youth MP. So carry on, Ed.
So we're in the select committee, and we're talking about reducing smoking rates. And everyone else is like, yes, well, we should put the taxes up, because you read the paper, and the paper provided by the bureaucrats, I guess, said, well, if you increase taxes of the cigarettes or the price of the cigarettes by 10%, it leads to a 2% reduction in demand for the cigarettes. And so everybody's sitting around, oh, what a good idea. Well, clearly, if you increase the price of the cigarettes, fewer people buy them. And I looked at that and said, this is terrible. That means that in economic terms, demand for cigarettes is highly inelastic. What that means is you increase the price by 10%, demand only goes down by 2%. That is terrible. And then I said to them, you've got to remember, who are the people who tend to smoke the most? It tends to be people with not a lot of money. And so I said, you can't ethically keep increasing the price of the cigarettes because they're so addictive. That's going to mean that people who are quite poor are spending a greater share of their income on these cigarettes. Like, that is a terrible thing to do. So first of all, increasing the price of cigarettes, I was like, it doesn't really work based on these numbers. Secondly, you've got these terrible distributional impacts on people's incomes. I said, what we've got to be focusing on is either alternatives or how we get people off cigarettes to encourage them to move away rather than just punishing the people who are currently smoking. And I know that's a really unpopular position, right? Because now, you know, we live in a world where smoking rates are kind of quite low and they are decreasing. And the price of a pack of cigarettes, I think, is something like $30, maybe slightly above $30. But it still worries me about people who are on very low incomes, who are so addicted that they are spending a very large amount of money on cigarettes that they can't actually afford. Now, I'm not saying that cigarettes should be very low cost because that makes it better. But I'm just saying raising the price is not necessarily always the best decision.
No,
now, anyway, I've gone on an absolute rant here, Rodney, but I felt passionate back about it in 2010 and I still feel passionate about it today. But what was interesting was sitting in the room with these other youth MPs and, like, I couldn't get it across the line to say, but just increasing the price doesn't work. I know the bureaucrats have said, oh, it's a very effective solution because you increase the price by 10% and the demand comes down by 2%. But you shouldn't read that and say, that's great. You should read that and say, it doesn't actually work.
No. It's fascinating. And, of course, you've got to bring in black market and what else they'll do. I was very proud to have you as my youth MP. I was very proud of all my youth MPs. And I'm even more proud now, Ed. Pride can be a sin, but I think if you accomplish things, you deserve to be take pride in it. And you've done extremely well in every aspect of your life. And I've enjoyed interviewing you. I remember you in 2010, 11 years ago. Was it? No. God, 14 years ago.
14 years ago, yeah.
How old were you then?
I would have been 17.
And to see you now is quite something.
Well, it's very kind of you to say. I really appreciate it.
No, I mean it most genuinely. And, of course, it's very easy. I went and had the experience yesterday of buying some timber in Cromwell. And it's easy to stay online. And you get all dark about people and the madness of what's going on in the world. And I went over to Placemakers in Cromwell and I got some timber, big stack, and they ended up driving a truck over to drop it off because it was too much for my trailer. And I got some chicken feed because I got chickens now for my daughter. That's a whole story. I could do a whole podcast on chickens now. And everywhere I went, people were so wonderfully kind and so wonderfully helpful, going out of their way to get what I wanted and to get it delivered, to get it where I wanted it. And I thought, it's so easy to read the news and to listen to politics and to think that we have descended into this hell of people. But going about your normal business, people are amazing. Harry people, Argentinian people I dealt with, European people. And we are truly blessed, aren't we? And I feel truly blessed with you on my show and with our listeners. And it's easy to not see that. And you're truly blessed, but you've worked hard, right?
Yeah, you work hard. You've got to do your best. But I think take a few risks. But you are right that it's very easy to overemphasize the bad and not look at the good. Now, I think I'm guilty of always being the eternal optimist. But just to share a couple of stats to back that up, I was looking at since the year 2000, what's happened to inflation, the cost of living, and incomes. And would you believe it, the average income in New Zealand was about $51,000, $52,000 back in 2000. Today, the average income, household income, is $132,000.
Whoa.
So household incomes have gone up about 160% over the last 24 years. The cost of living is up just over 80%. So incomes have risen twice as fast as the cost of living. Now, you wouldn't know that today. You wouldn't know that our lives are getting so much better over time because we've got this recency bias. We were saying, yes, but over the last year, incomes have gone up slower than inflation. And so we're feeling the pain that we're currently in. But if we take that longer term perspective, the world is getting much, much better as time goes on. Now, of course, you can point to examples. You'd be right to, listeners would be right to, of things that are not going right in the world. But I see a lot of good things happening.
Yes,
and,
indeed.
You know, even if you think about what's going to happen in Africa over the next 50 years, Africa's probably going to become more and more important and richer, and there are going to be hundreds of millions of people pulled out of poverty. And I think that is just such a beautiful thing.
Beautiful thing. Ed McKnight from Opes Partners, O-P-E-S, property advisors for a residential investment. Ed McKnight's podcast. You can hear more of him. What's the podcast again, Ed?
The Property Academy podcast.
On Apple.
Apple, Spotify, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Isn't that funny? You put it up on, these days you put it, I hear that, you put it up on lots and lots of podcasts.
Yeah, people listen on different places. So wherever you want to be, we'll be there for you.
Say it again, what that podcast is.
Yeah, the Property Academy podcast.
There you go. Well, it's been wonderful. Been truly blessed to have Ed McKnight along. I feel terrible when I look back on it because we ended up going off track and talking about lots of things. But there you go. I guess that's part of the fun of an interview and someone being up front like Ed is and me knowing him when he was 17. Oh, my goodness. You're on Reality Check Radio, Real Talk with Rodney Hyde. Please send us a text, 2057. Email me, inbox@realitycheck.radio. And we have a bright future with the likes of an Ed in it, don't we indeed?
Are you loving what you're hearing? Well, the establishment hates it, and right now they're conjuring up new ways to try and censor RCR. To ensure you never miss a beat of the hard-hitting news you've come to know and love, make sure you're on the RCR mailing list. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.